other yak babies. Sex, presidents, and sometimes books.
Welcome to Yak Babies, the only podcast on the internet sponsored by Tree Frogs. Hard to catch when you're on a horse. My name is Aaron. I'm here with my personal pals, Dave.
Hey, Aaron.
Brick.
Hey, Aaron.
And Nico.
Hello.
Calling from all the way in Old Ireland. This is our What Are We Reading episode. Regularly, we come together and talk about what we're reading. In the past, I've been doing it in different combinations, like comics and nonfiction and fiction, different episodes. We're recombining them because our reading sort of schedules have changed a bit. So this is back to an omnibus edition of What Are We Reading. So I want to hear from Brick. What are you reading?
Well, I read Under the Volcano, but I'm not going to talk about it because we're going to do that separate as a whole separate episode because I'm not the only one that read it. Mm. It was very good. So I also read House of X and Power of X, the X-Men comics.
Good choice.
Maybe we can circle back to those when you do yours. Are you also talking about those?
Yeah.
Yeah, so I'll save because you're going to have more to say than me because I was both entertained and enjoying it and largely confused for a lot of it. So
right.
I'll join in on yours. So I have a couple books. I'm not sure my personal pals would like that much, but I liked quite a bit. Hmm. One is called Eleanor Oliphant is Completely Fine by Gail Honeyman, which was very good. And another one called Far from the Tree by Robin Benway. They're pretty accessible kind of novels. Like this isn't this Eleanor Oliphant books in Reese Witherspoon's book club.
Oh, nice.
Which apparently is a thing.
I didn't know that was a thing.
Reese Witherspoon.
Yeah, she really wants to be the next Oprah or something.
But only for books.
So this one's about a woman who sort of lives on her own. It takes place in, I think, Glasgow. And she had a pretty serious traumatic childhood. So a lot of the book is about her learning to kind of be social despite her weird idiosyncrasies. Mm-hmm. And then as it goes on, she kind of develops a friend that maybe is a romance, but really it's just a friendship, which is something she hadn't really had. And then she kind of comes to term with the abuse that she suffered as a kid. It's pretty funny. Hmm. And it does, I think, a pretty good job of, I think a lot of times books about trauma and mental illness tend to maybe too purposefully try and pull at your heartstrings a little bit and kind of like maybe play the pity card or the twist card. Where this one is much more just sort of, yeah, this is how this lady's life is, you know, and she's weird, but she's weird for a reason. And it's part of who she is. It's not something to be fixed. So I really liked it. And then Far From the Tree was similar. It was about three kids who had been put up for adoption when they were babies.
Hmm.
And then they're all teenagers in the book. It's written for teens. So it's not if you're not interested in that, it's not going to be something that's going to blow your mind. But for what it was really good. And it would be a good book, particularly for kids, which is why I was reading these for kids in that situation. So the book's about two sisters and a brother who were separated and put up for adoption when they were babies and then learning of and connecting to each other in their teens. And then they all have their own sort of, one of them ended up bouncing through fosters their whole life. One of them ended up joining a family as the adopted sibling, and one of them was a single child. Hmm. So they all kind of had a different life experience, and they came back together and kind of explored, like, you know, how do you have a new family when you already have a family, or don't, right? And how do you welcome that into your life and adjust to that? And it was a pretty good book.
Yeah.
That one actually won, I don't have it with me, that one won the National Book Award for YA.
Oh, cool.
My notes are somewhere, I think a couple years ago. And then finally, as promised on Twitter, I picked up The Cockroach.
We discussed this a bit on the Christmas episode that you were going to read this because you were probably going to get it. You did.
By my boy Ian McEwan.
Oh, God.
It's a slim volume.
It is a slim volume.
And big font.
Yep.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. So, I mean, 99 pages.
Wow. He shit this out.
He did. Yeah, he certainly did. So, if you rewind back in the podcast history and find when I talked about his last book, Machines Like Me, you can pretty much substitute some of the details for this book, some of the details of that, and it's the same thing. So
yeah.
There's some great writing and some pretty good ideas forced into a conceit that they don't need to be forced into. Mm-hmm. So basically what this is, I need to look at my notes actually.
His last few books seem like forced into conceits.
It's really the last three. If
nutshell,
not.
The Hamlet's a fetus.
Yep. Yep.
Yeah.
Which sucks because the writing's really good and it's strange because there are some pretty good, so the basis of this book is The Metamorphosis by Kafka combined with Brexit. So yeah, it's fucking stupid. It doesn't fit into there's like another better story in there. Like just the Brexit story, I think would have been all right. But then the other stuff just becomes a punchline. So this bug wakes up and he's a man and he's the prime minister And then they put through this thing called reversalism, which is this idea that, like, through political sort of force of will, the economy is turned inside out. So instead of you being paid to work, you pay to work. Right. It sounds more complicated than it is, but so everything's turned around. So employees pay companies. Like, if you get pulled over for a speeding ticket, the cop gives you money, blah, 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 blah. But you're fined if you don't produce. Right. So,
okay.
So, like, basically the laws are structured. It's detailed enough that, like, obviously it would never work, but it's played out logically that, like, and that aspect of the workbook works pretty well as this kind of, like, Orwellian sort of, like, very clear criticism of just sort of the machinations of the economy in general and how the whole thing is kind of fucked up and rigged and not based on anything besides the levers of power. Hmm. So, like, that, there was a book in there that was pretty good, except for then it turned out there was Bugmen.
So weird.
You know, it's like, okay. So, like, then there's just, like, really very flimsy Trump and Theresa May and Boris Johnson stuff in there that just didn't need to be there. And basically the book ends on a punchline where all the politicians turn back into bugs and scurry away. And they're like, ha, 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 we fucked it up. And now we get to enjoy the fruits of a disunified world because that is works to the benefit of bugs. And it's like, oh, all right. So... like, you know, and so it's super frustrating. And none of it made sense because it turns out that the prime minister he turned into was the same guy. So maybe the bugs took over their bodies. Like, it didn't,
right.
He didn't, that aspect of the book was clearly not thought through and right. It didn't make any sense. And it was just, he needed to make that idea work in order to put it on the cover of his book.
Mm. I think he's just got like two wheels that he spins, and one is a bunch of classic books and the other one is a bunch of stupid ideas. And like last time he got Hamlet and like fucking, what was it, like 60 perspectives or whatever, and then this time, or no, Hamlet as a fetus,
Hamlet and then, a fetus,
and then this time it's the metamorphosis and Brexit. It's like it just doesn't make any sense. I don't feel like they're complementing each other at all.
They're not, and they're working against each other. Because the truth is, the political stuff in this book could have been pretty good. Like, it was on the nose, but again, Orwell was on the nose, right? And like, it was done well enough, and it was interesting enough that if it had been this kind of weird parallel present, that like, here's what would happen if just all this like insanity somehow, like there was an okay book there,
right?
And then it was just ruined by bugs that didn't need to be there and didn't. It really feels like he had this idea that he wanted to write a criticism of sort of Brexit in the political moment, but he didn't know how to start and finish it. So then he like flipped through his dumb notebook of like vehicles, right? And he's like, oh yeah, and then he just kind of crammed it in there, but then only took a draft or two to make it work, and then didn't even bother like filling the holes
because really
it just didn't fit, but it also didn't seem like he was trying that hard to fit. It was like, yeah, fuck it, you guys get it. It's the
right.
It didn't help.
It feels like a loss of nerve in some way, right? Like,
he's such a good writer, it's infuriating. So I don't.
And why wouldn't you trust yourself at that level in your career with that much skill and success to write a complicated but interesting novel about this sort of like kind of dystopian economy in the UK without having to rely on a really dumb pastiche of another classic novel? Like, what's the game there?
I know, and it's three in a row. So, I mean, I don't know. The reviews for this were pretty savage.
I can't imagine.
So, hopefully he'll just take a few years off and write a real book.
Yeah, really.
You know?
Yeah.
Because literally the last three books have followed the exact same pattern. And the few he wrote before that were not his best books, but also at least still their own thing.
Right.
But this, The Machines Like Me before it, and then Nutshell, all three of them followed that same sort of like trying to cram one story into like something else's body.
Right.
You know, which, you know, somewhat ironically, I guess, is like literally the plot of this book, where like one thing got crammed inside another thing's body and then that fucked everything up. So right. I don't know, maybe he's just on a galaxy brain thing and we don't see it yet, but what I really think is he needs an editor to tell him that that's not a real idea. That's an idea that like that's a workout you do in your writer office, and then you don't publish that.
Right.
you know, so I don't know. And also this came out like less than a year from Machines Like Me. So
right. That's what I was saying.
I don't know if he's just trying to like just need some royalties real bad and is like just digging out the notebook. And like it seems like it was two partial novels hastily cobbled together, and not even novels because the whole thing's 99 pages. So two exercises just like sewed together and then given another pass to like make it passably cohesive. But it's not a thoughtful work of writing in any way, really.
Right.
And, which is a shame because just like the last few, there's good stuff in there. It just doesn't fit.
Right. Very weird.
Yeah.
Nico, what about you?
I read, by the way, that Eleanor Oliphant book last year. Our book club.
Did you like it?
Yeah, it was pretty good. It was one of those, seems like it's one of those books that it doesn't try to do too much. It's just like a very simple plot.
That's what I liked about it, because a lot of times the books like that try to really like get you.
Yeah, and there's no like, there's no big twist. Like the guy who seems to be her friend at work doesn't turn out to be an asshole. He's just like her friend, and they slowly develop a friendship, and then that's it.
Yeah.
And then she's like a little bit happier at the end than she is at the beginning. I was like, all right, cool, I feel good
after reading. Yeah, it was a nice example of a literary novel that sort of finds its own little angle and doesn't try to be really any more than what that angle is, which I appreciate.
Right. Yeah. Which is, I think, harder than it looks.
I agree.
Last month in the book club we read a book called The Silent Patient. I don't know if that's big. I think it's a UK book, but it's like everywhere over here. It's decent. It's like a thriller. There's a woman who kills her husband supposedly, and then her like psychiatrist wants to, and then as soon as she kills her husband, she never speaks another word for like 20 years, and her psychiatrist wants to help her talk again, and it's pretty good. It's better than I would say most thrillers. And then I tried to read a book, or tried to listen to the audiobook of this book called Fall or Dodge in Hell, which is quite a title, by Neal Stephenson.
Wait, Fall or what?
Fall or Dodge in Hell.
Okay.
That's this Neal Stephenson book. It's a sequel to Reamde, which I read back and reviewed actually for Chamber 4. That was long enough ago that Chamber 4 was still around. I think it was 2012 when that came out. And
I think so.
That book was like a super long, new age Neal Stephenson, like whatever you would call like the 20, I guess this century, like what you would charitably call a maximalist, which means he just like fucking talks about everything. He explains everything. Like, oh, this car has, you know, six gears. Let's talk about gears on a car for like 20 pages. And that can be good and bad. Like sometimes he doesn't take a lot of care with how interesting that, you know, page to page writing is. A lot of times it's pretty boring, but it can be good because like you have a really fucking solid framework for everything. You understand every little minutia of this shit. So the first one, Reamde, was this book about a game developer who gets super rich, and then his granddaughter or something, niece, I guess, gets kidnapped. And he like has to like go after her basically. And it was like, it was not a very highbrow, like kind of adventure thriller kind of thing, but it was like pretty entertaining. And this one is the sequel to that. So I was like, okay, I was like ready, and I hadn't read anything about it. So I went into it like ready for the same kind of thing, like kind of a better Tom Clancy book basically. And instead, so you're following the main character, who's this rich game developer. His name is, his alter ego is Dodge. He goes to do a routine surgery, eats a croissant before the surgery against the doctor's orders, and fucking dies. And it's like, what? it's like 75 pages in, he fucking dies on the table. And it's like, is this real? And then it turns out that what the book is about is he's one of those people who wants to freeze his brain after he dies. Okay. And so they do that, but then they don't figure out a way to resurrect his body, but they do figure out a way to digitize his brain. So they put his consciousness in basically a version of his game. And then other people start doing that, and these like consciousnesses come online in this digital world. It gets super, super weird. I'm halfway through. It's fucking 30 hours long, the audiobook, which I think translates to about 1,000 pages. And I don't think I'm going to finish it. It gets super biblical, which is weird, not moralistic or anything, but in style, it gets biblical. Like, it's like, and then he spake
unto... Like the pro style?
Yeah. And then he's like, and then he spake unto his followers and told them, do not go unto that place. Like, follow me and do... And it's like, I don't
sounds
get...
terrible.
I don't get why it got biblical, but... It, and so basically this digital world gets remade according to what the bodiless consciousnesses want to do with it. And they're basically all powerful because they don't, you know, have bodies and there's no physics really. So they can do whatever they want. He just kind of builds all this shit. And that's about as far as I've gotten. And then also it follows like his family outside who are kind of negotiating the logistics of like maintaining the digital world where all of these people live in the afterlife.
Right.
And I think it's one of those things where his new style, that maximalist style, really combines with the subject matter to make it really fucking boring for like a while. And I think I'm done with it. He's super weird now. He's really doing the Ian McEwan thing where he seems to have enough money that he's just going to do whatever the fuck he wants. And he doesn't care what his editor says. And he seems to have enough readers the publisher will let him.
Right. That's a new like literary school is doing the Ian McEwan thing, which is where an author just goes bug shit.
I feel like Ian McEwan might owe some money to some mobsters or something.
Yeah. That sounds pretty gimmicky.
He's just like, fine, just open up, just take whatever you can out of my notebook. Just get off me. Just don't break my fucking knees. Look, here's my books from when I was a teenager. There's something. Just take that and then put it into Brexit.
Yeah. So that's pretty much it for me.
Sounds like a bummer. Dave, what about you?
I had, as you guys know, a pretty poor showing when we went on the Modern Library top 100 list.
Mm, right.
And so that was a little bit humiliating. So I have a goal of working through, or not working through, it's not work, but reading some more of those books on that list that I missed. Under the Volcano is obviously one, and we'll be talking about that later in a group read.
Yeah.
I read The Bridge of San Luis Rey.
Oh, yeah.
Which I think Brick talked about last time.
I've read that.
And you read it recently, right? Didn't we?
No, I read it.
Feels like you talked about it on a recent
episode. We talked about it when we went through the...
Was it on that episode?
On that episode. Okay. I read it back when, in the C4 days, so 10-ish years ago.
Okay. It was good. I guess with a lot of these, I don't feel like I'm going to have anything really to add to the discussion about them. It's a good book. It's a quick read. I get why it was on there. I don't think it's really going to stick with me very much.
Right.
But I enjoyed it. It's artfully done. I read a book called Ironweed.
Oh, yeah.
By William Kennedy.
Yeah, right.
Can we just pause while Aaron adjusts his life here?
Sorry. That's very graphic, yeah.
Yeah.
It's peanut butter. Oh, jeez.
Maybe wrap the cord around so it doesn't the gravity doesn't pull against you. Let's do this.
Yeah. Okay, we're good.
This is chaos. Ironweed, it was published in the early 80s. Pulitzer winner, too, kind of.
Right.
I guess I wouldn't call it forgotten, but, like, you never hear about it.
It was made into a movie, maybe?
It was made into a movie with Jack Nicholson and Meryl Streep, which is also forgotten. Like,
yeah.
With, especially a movie with those two people. It's like,
right.
What happened to that? I'm curious to see it. The gist is, and it's a, like, Kennedy wrote a whole cycle of novels set in Albany, New York. And this is one of them. This is an entry in that series about a guy. It's Depression era, and he returns to Albany after a couple of decades away. He's kind of like a alcoholic, down on his luck sort of drifter. And he was married and he had a family. He had kids, but he dropped one of his kids. Like, he picked up his baby and the baby fell out of the diaper and it died.
Fuck.
And so he kind of left because he couldn't deal with that. But also, when he left, he was like a professional baseball player in the major leagues. So unless I got confused on the timeline, but it feels like he dropped his kid, he left Albany and his family, and became a professional baseball player for the Washington Senators.
Wow.
In the very early 20th century.
Jesus.
So that was an interesting part of the plot for me.
What if that wasn't true and you just like insert becoming a professional baseball player into any novel that you're reading?
That's possible, for sure. But I really like this book, and I plan to read it again. The dialogue in particular was just excellent. It reminded me, it was like really kind of rapid, back and forth, clipped, sort of like, it felt to me like Hemingway-esque, but in a good way. Like better than Hemingway, but what would remind a lot of us of Hemingway.
Right.
And the story was well done. I really enjoyed it and can heartily recommend it if it sounds like it's up your alley.
Yeah.
So I've read those three from that list, and I don't know what's next. Maybe The Heart is a Lonely Hunter, which I know you like a lot.
Yeah, I love that book.
And I've never read, yeah.
It's a great one.
Get ready to hate it.
Oh, no. You hated it?
No, I just wanted you to goodbye Columbus Aaron again.
That's a verb now. A goodbye Columbus thing.
I will not recommend it. I will just let you read if you want to.
Okay. So yeah, I'm going to keep going down that list, but while also pursuing other things. Like, for example, I reread Kevin Berry's, Nico's County Sligo neighbor, Berry's new novel, Night Boat to Tangier, which is excellent. I just continue to love almost everything that guy writes, and it feels like he's just getting better and better.
I got a copy of that. We should do that for next
We're talking about doing that for a group read, so maybe I'll hold off on getting too deep into it, and we're kind of running late on time anyway, so
we can just skip Aaron.
I'll shove it.
Aaron read comic books.
Yeah, I can stop there.
That's cool. I like the sort of modern library list reading challenge for you. That's a good one.
Yeah.
That's fun. I got a couple things. One I started reading, I'm almost finished with, but not quite there, is a collection. It's an anthology of music writing called Please Go the Way. It's about power pop, and it's edited by Paul Myers, who is Mike Myers' brother. And it's really good.
Give me a quick definition of power pop, or maybe a couple examples.
Power pop is like Cheap Trick and Big Star, like bands that took Beatles-esque sort of pop and combined it with a bit more of like a rock edge. So it's mostly popular in the late 70s and through the 80s. The Knack is a good like power pop touchstone. My Sharona is like a classic power pop anthem. And so there's lots of essays in various, you know, about various power pop artists and movements, and it's really good. Some of them are not so great. There was one that was about Alex Chilton. It was basically a memoir, like a reminiscence of living in the same building that Alex Chilton lived in New York, and it was really tedious and boring, and it felt like a lot of them felt like first drafts, and I was really kind of bummed by that. But there's a Michael Chabon essay about Big Star in there. It's very good, that I think was lifted from liner notes he wrote for a Big Star box set, maybe. And
he has such a fucking weird career now. Do you know he's the showrunner of the Picard show?
Is he really?
Yeah.
Come on.
Isn't that weird?
Wow. That's really wild. I've heard that show is really good, so I wonder if he's
part of it. I'm sure he has something to do with that, yeah.
That's really interesting. There's another essay in there by, do you remember Dave Holmes from the MTV VJ Challenge? Way back in the late 90s, there was the Who Wants to Be a VJ, I think was the name of it, and it was like a MTV thing, like who, it was like a fan contest.
He did the karaoke show too, didn't he?
He did, yeah, yeah. And he also hosted 120 Minutes for a while too. He was the second, he was the runner-up, so Jesse Camp won, and Jesse Camp was like this weird like cartoon of a man.
Right.
And Dave Holmes was an actual music dork, but he was on MTV for a long time. He's now he's a comedian. He does host podcasts and is a writer as well and a music critic. He wrote a really great essay about Tommy Keane, who's an artist I'd never heard of before. Started listening to it and really liked it. So I'm discovering cool things, which is nice. But yeah, definitely enjoying that. And then I did pick up Goodbye Columbus again just to... Well, I saw that Brick had bought it. And so I was like, maybe we can do a book club of this. Maybe in the future we'll do a story club about Goodbye Columbus. I'll
read it for the next one.
What's that?
I'll read it for the next time.
Yeah. I wanted to make sure that I was right. And so far I am. So well, more on that soon. Comics-wise, Break, you mentioned House of X and Powers of X. I did finish that. I really loved it. I thought it was fantastic.
Yep.
We were talking earlier about how it probably helps to have a Wikipedia article open or entry open for reading those because it does require some deeper knowledge. And
I was missing a lot of context. There was a whole bunch where I just... And that coupled with the sort of, not really time travel, but like parallel... I don't know how to describe it. It's not really time travel. It's time sort of permutations.
Yeah, it's like multiple timelines, right? It's not time travel. It's sort of like kind of like looking at it because more...
It just keeps redoing it.
Resetting time, yeah.
Yeah. So that combined with... You know, and we've talked in the past, one of the hardest things of comics for me is knowing, like, when I need to find context externally and when I need to just, like, sit back and let the story bring it to me.
Yeah.
And then, so it was not something that was super forthcoming. But then there's others, like, I didn't know really anything about Apocalypse, but the book offered enough about Apocalypse that I knew what I needed to about him.
Yeah.
But then there was other characters, like, who the fuck is Zorn?
Right, yeah.
You know, so I just kind of moved through those things. And
that's, I mean, the question, who is Zorn, is a very complicated question itself. So
is it, though?
I think I have more knowledge than you did, but even then I was still like, I had to look up a lot of people and sort of just refresh what they were, what their most recent story was, or like who, where they came from. But within that, the structure I think was really interesting.
Yeah.
The moving back in time and the ideas. So the main conceit of these books is that they kind of have reset the X-Men so that they live all together on this big living island called Krakoa.
It's two islands.
Yeah, right. Two islands, which is like a living thing. And it's a basically a new country where all mutants are citizens. So if you're a mutant, you can go live in Krakoa and you belong here. But they've also, as part of, in doing that, they have offered to the world essentially a peace treaty, like an economic peace treaty, which is...
offered is not really what they did, though.
Kind of like forced, yeah.
Yeah.
They've developed these like super drugs that cure all disease and all these other sort of various benefits as long as they accept and acknowledge the existence and validity of the mutant country. And so it's like a political thriller kind of on top of a superhero story, and there's some emotional resonance too. It's really interesting.
It's also written on, there's like four like timelines.
Yeah.
And then there's 10 repeating loops of the timelines.
So yeah.
There's the main narratives take place like year one, year 10, year 100, and year 1,000, right? Or 10,000?
I think maybe it's even like 100, 10,000, 100, or something like that.
Yeah. So there's like what happens, like the X-Men, they're basically, I assumed that they were different arcs of like X-Men through history.
Kind of.
Is what it seems like, right? And then, so then the larger narrative is sort of what, it ends up being humans versus mutants versus machines, and yeah, like sort of what is the order of operations there. These kind of three groups kind of dominating for power over like a pretty lengthy period of time.
Yeah.
And then the mutants' ability to sort of reset time, or at least try again,
right,
on time periods. The book works through the permutations on them trying to find long-term existence.
Yeah, there's one mutant who can... when she dies, she's reborn, and she comes with all the knowledge in the previous timeline, a previous life. So she is this like vehicle for sharing knowledge across literal generations of time to try and improve the mutant cause.
So this wasn't answered in the book. I don't know if you know the answer. Is every time she's born, is that a different timeline?
Mm-hmm.
So the other ones remain existing?
They exist parallel to this new timeline.
Okay, so it's not a reset so much as a start from a copy kind of thing.
Yeah, like everything would have happened up to her birth kind of the same way, but then she can alter, like there's that.
That's my question. Is she altering like a timeline, or is, because there's one part where they talk about she's going to disappear and they're going to replace her with like a golem on that timeline.
Yeah.
So that timeline continues to exist, and then she just moves over to a different kind of reality?
I think maybe like her death creates a new time stream, probably.
Okay. Yeah, it's just complicated.
Yeah. The charts are helpful.
Yeah.
But you have to really dig into them. Because
that stuff was cool, though. So in between different sections, there's little bits of narrative, and then there's like charts and sort of rosters.
Yeah,
and
explainers.
Things. And it's all kind of presented as sort of historical documents, or like a peek inside of someone's database.
Yeah.
You know, and it was like the way it was presented was, I thought, really nice and remained within the aesthetic of the story.
Yeah, that's a Jonathan Hickman thing. So the writer Jonathan Hickman, I talked about him a lot in the past because I really loved his book Manhattan Projects, I think is what it's called, right? It was about the what if all the nuclear scientists and physicists who were around the 50s like were on one compound, and what if things went crazy and they became this like weird like sci-fi fighting force. He's really interested in that kind of like infographic kind of stuff, and so his books are filled with it. So there's lots of charts and diagrams, and it's almost a joke sometimes, like, oh, Hickman's, there's gonna be some charts, but these charts I found really interesting. It was kind of fun to add to the sort of world building. I'm still reading. So these two books launched essentially a new status quo for the X-Men, and there was, I think, 7 books came out of that. I didn't read all of them because I just didn't have the patience or really interest, but I did pick up X-Men and the X-Force book, and they're both very good. So if you want a taste of more of that, there's more out there. You can kind of go in and get a little bit and move out if you need to. What I really want to talk about, my sort of favorite pick recently, is this book, a comic by Jonathan Luna and Lauren Keeley called 20XX by Image Comics. There's only 3 issues out so far, and it's fantastic. I really, really like it. I knew nothing about it before I went into it. The Luna brothers, I had never really consumed their work before, only a couple short stories here and there. I never really liked it because the art bugs me. It's a bit too smooth, and so I never really wanted to get into it, so I kind of had problems with it. But I was intrigued by just the cover of the first issue, and I thought I'd give it a shot, and it's really, really cool. So Jonathan Luna is working on story, and he's doing the illustration, and Lauren Keeley is writing the script and also working on story too. This is a sort of like a dystopian future kind of concept, and I've talked before about how one of my problems with modern comics is A lot of them tend to be, there's a story and then a dumb sci-fi element or a dumb fantasy element to kind of give it a twist. And I really hate that stuff. I'm bored with it. It seems like an easy trick. This one, it does do that, but in the, I think, the best possible way. So the idea here is that this is, it's set in Alaska in the future, some, you know, ambiguous 20XX future. There's a disease that if you catch it, you die. Like 90% of the time, you're going to die from this disease, like no matter what's fatal. But 10% of the people survive. And when they survive and recover, they all of a sudden have telekinesis. And their telekinesis manifests in specific ways. They can only sort of move or deal with certain kinds of material. So some people have telekinesis for glass. Some people have it for wood or sort of for like soft tissues or whatever.
So they're like airbenders, basically.
Oh, yeah. I think, yeah, totally. It sounds very similar to that, yeah. So our main character gets the disease. She's like, she works for some ad agency, I think. Gets the disease. She recovers. And once you get telekinesis, if you recover, you're ostracized. So you have to go live outside of the society. So she, you know, is told by the government she has to move out. And she's not allowed to use her powers. And they're kind of monitored. She ends up joining a resistance movement. And there's these two rival gangs that are competing for control of the kind of outsider city. I know it's really interesting. I'm really 100% engaged with it. Even though the art is not, I am growing to appreciate it more. It still bugs me sometimes, but I like it a lot more. It's very, very precise, which is interesting. And the story is very good. The characters are all very clear. The concept was set up initially without too much hassle, and it feels like it belongs as one piece. It's not this weird a relationship story with a sci-fi twist for no reason. The sci-fi twist seems like part of the story, which is what I'm looking for in these kinds of comics. I think we could even be doing this as a comic club if you guys wanted to. It might be up your alley. So if you're curious, go check out the first issue and see if it strikes you or not. And if it does, maybe we can talk about this more in the future. Well, that is what we've been reading. It's a lot. What are you reading? Listeners, tell us on Twitter at YakBabies and email us at YakBabiesPodcast@gmail.com. Also find us on Patreon.com/YakBabies. So much fun to be had there for $1 a month. There are games. There's Power Hours, plural. There's
Powers Hour.
It's like Attorneys General. Powers
Hour. We got fantasy drafts there. We got Bro to Bros. We got excerpts of conversations that you shouldn't be hearing. All that for $1. Check it out there. Until then, YakBabies yakking off.
The Yak Babies wish to thank all the personal pals who listen each week, and most especially to send extra thanks to all who have supported on Patreon past and present, including Michael, Bonnie, Sebastian, and William Howard Taft.